Stephen Wade, age 64, is 13th of April, 2017, in Chicago at the former home of the Chicago Public Library, now the Chicago Cultural Center. And I'm being interviewed by Matt Brown, who is really the future of old-time music. He's a wonderful person and a very talented man. I met him when he was 6 years old. Isn't that right? And he was smiling then. I remember he had this wonderful spirit about him.
My name is Matt Brown. I'm 32 years old right now, and it's Thursday, April 13th, 2017. We're here in Chicago, Illinois. And I'm here speaking with Stephen Wade, who is a living legend of American music scholarship and performance and a dear friend and mentor. So, Stephen, we're here today centered around your experience with the Old Town School, and I wanted to start by just asking you what your first encounters were with the Old Town School.
Well, I was a little boy, and I walked by. I'm from Chicago, and I walked by the original location of the Old Town School on North Avenue. And I just remember it was late in the afternoon because they had those, they had these sort of yellow film-like curtains down for the sun, to block the sun. I don't think they were green. I think they were yellow or amber-colored. And I remember seeing a guitar behind it, just sort of a lone guitar in the window, as it were, but being protected from being baking. And I was fascinated because I was already, you know, in the thrall of this music. But I didn't associate, because the associations of folk music at that time, so if I'm six or seven, the folk boom that's ignited by the Kingston Trio is going on. That wasn't the music I was after. So I was after something of a different quality, which for me was first present through Chicago blues, rhythm and blues music. And I was conscious of that music in a sense. I remember feeling then kind of almost like a choice. Well, that folk music, I thought of it as sort of more sophisticated or uptown or Philly or happy. And it wasn't a broad definition of folk music. It was rather a commercial definition of folk, because that was what was being heard throughout the radio as folk music and identified as such. So I did, and I knew that whatever it was I was interested in. I'd heard when I was about five, I don't know how, I guess it must have been a radio broadcast, I imagine it was Earl Scruggs with Paul Warren, and that kind of three finger rolling underneath that fiddle. Just, I loved that. But the banjo records that my dad had were these Steamboat Round the Bend kind of records, which were not, I had enough of an ear to know that's not the same thing. And those are the sort of, barbershop quartets. And I'm looking over Four Leaf Clover, which was kind of a hit back then and that was sort of happy music with strumming on the banjo. And that wasn't for me. And so whatever it was that I sensed with the Earl Scruggs thing, and certainly couldn't put a name to it, and hadn't witnessed it, I knew there was something, there wasn't the continuity to this other thing we had. So even though I thought then that I wanted to play the banjo, I obviously wasn't able to distinguish between a five-string banjo and a four-string banjo, except musically I could, but I didn't know that there were three kinds of banjos. And then I had this other image of folk music as well, those singing groups that emerged back then, Four Freshmen kind of thing, and not that they were, but you know what I'm saying. So so I gravitated to the blues, and then I started taking guitar lessons of that genre in the basement of Wurlitzer, a piano company just a few blocks south of here. And the South Wabash area was Music Row. There's a couple blocks there. That was called Music Row. And there was a conservatory of music where Ruth Crawford, before she was Ruth Crawford Seeger, went to school. And Lionel Healy was across the street. And, of course, the mail order houses were manufacturing, in vast quantities of instruments here, the harmony guitar and all that. But in the area where I was, this one or two block area, you had Carl Fisher Music for written music. You had the biggest record store in Chicago, Rose Records. And next to all of that, you had Wurlitzer. And in the basement there, I took guitar lessons from Jim Schwall. And Jim Schwall was one of the first white interpreters of blues music. And there were two bands. There was the Paul Butterfield Blues Band, and there was the Siegel Schwall Blues Band. And so I, and this is years, several years before they have actually recorded. But Corky remembers this little kid, little Stevie Wade, coming up and saying, I want to play blues banjo. And I, you know, it wasn't quite making sense, but he remembers me saying that, and I didn't prompt him. He does remember. So it really did happen, for what it's worth. Well, in my own personal sense of who I am, that it mattered. And then he... So I took lessons from Jim, and Jim and Corky would open for some of the great acts that had come up through the Great Migration to Chicago, like Howlin' Wolf and Muddy Waters. And so they would open, and sometimes they'd have matinees in the afternoon. And I didn't have helicopter parents, and I'd go, but I could have gone at night. But, I mean, during the daytime, during these matinees, the door would be swung open, and the reek of Blatt's beer would be coming out, and the blue smoke of Salem cigarettes. And I'd watch, see the audience listening to Muddy or Howlin' Wolf. I actually called Muddy on the phone, which was a pretty goofy thing to do. But, I mean, his real name was McKinley Morganfield, and how many are there in the phone book? And he was in the phone book at that time. He recognized quite quickly that it was a little kid, but he was very courteous, and it was very brief, and he asked me how old I was, and I just told him I really liked. And it was goofs. That's what I did. Anyway, so that was my first encounter with the Old Town School, was to sort of spurn it. But I got older, and what happened is I started playing the banjo, and there was a very famous primer called How to Play the Five-String Banjo by Pete Seeger, and on the front page of it, it said, special thanks and acknowledgement go to artist and banjo picker of Chicago, Fleming Brown. And I thought, well, who? And he had illustrated some of the pictures, and in a moment I'll try to remember to tell you why he did. Okay, so I went, then it occurred to me, well, maybe that's, I don't know, maybe Old Town School has something to do with this. So at that time, they had moved to 911 West Armitage, or 909, where the school is in one and the store was in the other. I went over there and I asked Evelyn Brightman, that was the lady behind the counter, I'm at the front desk, not counter, and I said, do you know of someone named Fleming Brown? She said, yeah, he's teaching here tomorrow night. And then I said, well, how many banjos does he have? she said, 15. I said, well, sign me up. And I saw him next night, and it was the greatest thing I'd ever heard. He just flooded the room with this big baritone voice, and he had this Paramount banjo, which I have now, and he gave me before he died. And in it is a little plate attached in it, screwed in it, by the motto of the Paramount banjo, piano volume, harp quality tone. And that was Fleming.
How old were you when you took that first class with him?
I was 18. And I'd already been playing banjo in Boston before then. I was interested in three-finger banjo, actually, and I was interested in chromatic banjo, too. I was hip to the Bill Keith record, Living on the Mountain with Jim Rooney, and I was I had seen Don Reno, and I had seen Earl Scruggs, and I had seen and met John Hartford, and they all played in Cambridge, and so I I'd already loved that music. I listened to Bill Monroe, and so I asked Fleming that first night if he could teach, and he said he couldn't teach me that stuff, and he didn't know chromatic banjo. And Scruggs, he said that system really didn't make sense for him. His mind wanted to play the melody as it was coming down, as opposed to playing around the melody, which in the three finger Scruggs style, you're surrounding the notes, and it just wasn't for him to do. And but on the other hand, his music was so beautiful and so powerful, and he was so compelling as a person that I was very fortunate. Now, the reason why Fleming illustrated that book is because in 1948, Pete Seeger was passing through Chicago with the Henry Wallace Progressive Party campaign, and Fleming had stumbled onto the five-string banjo and some recordings of actually Doc Walsh, he had heard, and he'd heard a record that came out that same year called Texas Gladden Sings Blue Ridge Ballads, which was a ballad singer from Virginia named Texas Gladden and her younger brother, Hobart Smith, and sort of half Hobart, half Texas. And some of the songs they played together as duets, one of them where you have Texas's high keening vocal and Hobart's banjo accompanying her, driving it underneath, was the ballad of Poor Ellen Smith. And that was the song that made Fleming want to play. In the same sense, there was a moment. That was the piece. He had to do this. And so he asked Pete Seeger, is there someone around Chicago who can teach me to banjo? He said, well, there's this fellow at the National Barn Dance down at 8th Street Theater, Doc Hopkins. Why don't you call him up? So Fleming called Doc at the station. And Doc said, well, okay, I can't teach you, but I can show you. Which is such a wonderful distinction of formal versus informal, those two domains. And he said, come around 5. And Fleming said, well, I'll make it 5:30. I get off. He said, no. I got off work at 5. No, five in the morning. That's when I do my wake-up show. And he did this morning show called the Smile a While Show. And so 3 times a week, Fleming would go down 8th Street Theater. They have, you know, he'd watch Doc do his radio show, and then Doc would show him stuff on the band show. And to thank Pete Seeger, Fleming, who was a commercial artist, offered to illustrate his book. At that time, Pete had the book in mimeograph form with a staple up in the left-hand corner holding it together. It's the next edition with the red cover. Fleming drew most of the pictures in the book. And if you look in the back, there's a big line drawing of a little boy with a banjo. It says, if you look on the side, it says WFB. That's William Fleming Brown. Fleming Brown. He used his middle name, which came from his mother, for his main name. He said, because he can't go through life named Bill Brown, he said. So he just went, that's how he saw it.
Could you describe your classroom experience in Fleming's, under Fleming's tutelage?
Oh, yes. I'll always remember it. It was in a small classroom on the second floor of the Turkle Room, named after Studs Terkel. And there were no curtains. There were hardwood, bentwood chairs. There was no rug, high ceilings, and big, two large glass windows. So sound bounced all the time, echoed, no matter how many people were in there. And we'd sit in a circle. He'd be in the front by the blackboard, and we'd sit around. And the way he conducted the classes, he would have each of us play for him, and then he would analyze and criticize and suggest other ways to play the tune. And then he would teach us a new tune by tablature. He would have written it out ahead of time, and they'd copy it out on the blackboard, and then we would write it down in our little manuscript books on the spot, because we didn't have little cell phones like you guys do to take the picture. But the advantage of doing it that way is, of course, you're immediately learning it. You're memorizing. And so that sort of rote method actually has old-fashioned, blue book speller type era of learning was useful. And so it was he totally spurned the second half. We never, ever went to the second half, which is the group singing at the old time. I have never gone to a second half until last year with you. That was the first time I ever went to one, Matt. I never, and it's wonderful and joyous, but Fleming had this attitude. He said, no milk and cookies for you. And that's what he called it. He was dragging us by the scruff of the neck into his vision of Appalachian music, and we were going to get there. And what was so important, wasn't the instrument you had. He said, if you can tune it enough, that the main thing is you learn the music. You buy records and you go visit people. Now, the buying records occurred and listening to records occurred in this very spot where we are, in this building here at Randolph in Michigan, probably in this quadrant of this very building where you're conducting this interview. It astonished me when we walked in here because I realized where we were physically. This is where the records were, and the recorded sound listening room was, essentially.
Or the library.
Of the Chicago Public Library. And that this main branch of Chicago Public Library is where the Library of Congress records were kept. And so it was here. Looking out that window there on the Michigan Avenue as rush hour buses lumbered past, listening to names, beguiling American names, Thaddeus Willingham from Gulfport, Mississippi, Luther Strong from Dalesburg, Kentucky, these names so very far away, and this contrast to the sort of our city environment, and thinking about what is this time, and who are these people, what is this music, and then and it struck me so hard to listen to that. And then, of course, those records, because they were conceived in ethnography rather than commerce, were recorded in people's homes and churches. Alan and John Lomax, I was thinking about our discussion this early this morning, and I remembered something that they wrote in the preface or forward or introduction to Our Singing Country, which was a marvelous songbook that came out in November 1941. It said, singing in their homes, at their churches, at their dances, they leave on these records imperishable spirals of their personalities, their singing style, and their cultural heritage.
Wow.
Imperishable spirals.
Unbelievable.
So that's what I sat in this room and watched those records. You know, it was esoteric for me, too, because they were in 78 RPM. I mean, I did grow up, in an era of 33 RPM, you know, and 45s, you know, which were the singles, you know, a hit song was out of 45.
Right.
But 78 was something I saw as a little boy, and our early record players always had 16, 33, and 78 on them, but I didn't really hear many. I don't think I heard 78s, my parents didn't have them, and they had plenty of records, you know.
You mentioned Hobart Smith. Could you talk a little bit about, or a lot, about the recordings that Fleming made of Hobart and their connection to...
Yes. So Fleming's inspiration to play is through that Hobart Smith recording that was issued in 1948 on Disc Records, which is the parent to Folkways. Now it's Smithsonian Folkways. But it's all the same corporate, same people, same vision, same continuity. And in 1963, Hobart Smith came to Chicago to play at the University of Chicago Folk Festival, which occurred at the very beginning of February that year. And that's when Fleming met Hobart Smith. And then that October, Hobart returned to Chicago and stayed with Fleming for 2 weeks, essentially doing a Midwest tour, which ended with a concert at the Old Town School and a workshop that they did. During the time that Hobart stayed with Fleming, was hoping to build up a tablature book to teach Hobart's music at the Old Town School, because he was a teacher there for 13 years. And so Hobart made the most extensive body of recordings of his life for Fleming, and they would play the tunes and then slow them down because Fleming was hoping to tablature out from that. The book never came together, and Hobart died and got rather ill, died in early 1965, and his last appearance was at Newport in 64, and I have the program book from then, and he it's astonishing. He plays like in every workshop. He's like you. He's a multi-instrumentalist. He played piano. He played guitar. He played fiddle. He said he could play. He told Fleming, I could play anything except a car bumper or a barbed wire fence. and so it was all music for him. And so he did play many instruments, and he had a great, great ear. And so those recordings then were these important documents, and they inspired Fleming for the rest of his life. And before he died, he gave me all the tapes, and he said, do something with this. And the look of pain in his eyes when he handed them over was unforgettable, because he knew these were some of the most primary documents and important documents that he would ever leave behind. So I did. I put together an album called From Those Many Hours, the primary performances, what I thought of what Hobart had done for Fleming. And I called it In Sacred Trust, and for three reasons. First, because of the story I just told you of Fleming handing it to me and saying, do something with it. And there was something sacred that had to be respected there, his wishes. The other second meaning, a level, as it were, of trust, was that if you listen to that album, those tapes, whatever form you hear it in, the confidence is shared between these two men of slightly different generations. Hobart's born in 1897. Fleming's born in the 20s. There's great admiration between them and trust between them, regardless of whatever differences they had of an upbringing. Mm. But most of all, the reason I call it In Sacred Trust, because if Hobart learned this music from largely black musicians in southwestern Virginia, both fiddle he got from an ex-slave who used to chop wood at their home, guy named Jim Spencer, banjo, similarly from a black source, and guitar. Then he names them all. He's different than many earlier accounts of... He's actually willing and to identify who he learned from. And he's learning this music. I mean, doesn't... He barely read or write. I mean, he's holding this music in his mind through a person's born during the Civil War, purely through memory and desire. He's holding them in sacred trust because he swears to Fleming. He says, I give you my hand to God. I haven't played that tune in 25 years, and I play it exactly like, you know, the person he learned it from. And however closely he really is playing it like that person before him, it is so important to him what he's continuing and carrying and expressing and renewing for Fleming. And so he's carrying them in sacred trust. And that's why I called that collection that. And I wrote a 80-page brochure with it. And that's, well, that's how it, and that's how it worked. Does that answer that?
That's brilliant.
Yeah, okay.
Colby Maddox, who's the director of the Resource Center at the Old Town School, before we arrived here today, sent me some photographs from your time at the school. And I wanted to show them to you just to see what memories they might spark.
Mm-hmm.
I've got four of them here.
Okay.
This top one is...
Oh, yeah. I remember that. That was at one of the parties. They had these all-night parties. I think that's the Chicago Fire Party in 1974 or something like that. Is that
you mean for the department? Chicago Fire Department?
They called the party the Chicago Fire because of the big
Great
conflagration.
There we go.
And it was an all-night thing, and anybody neighbor could come to this thing, and people played in every room all the time. There I am with, yeah, that's where that was taken. That is me. Here, show that to Salvador. Yeah.
Which banjo is that?
That is, I have that banjo in L.A. That's a tubaphone with a 11 and 7/8 inch head. It's a tubaphone style M with a 5-string neck that a local maker named Rich Olson made the neck for. I got it from a friend of Fleming's who was in a divorce. I'll leave his name off the radio, who needed some money, and that's how I got that banjo. My first banjo I bought up at Old Joe Clark's musical cooperative in Cambridge and from a man named Sandy Sheehan.
Right. My dad worked for him at Sandy's Music.
Is that right?
Small world.
Yes.
How about this one? This is you on stage with whom else?
Oh, let me take off my glasses. Isn't that with John Prine and Bonnie Kolak and Corky Siegel? Yeah, that's at Orchestra Hall.
When was that?
Well, that was 86 or 87, wasn't it? When we raised all that money for the school, and they have that plaque in the front door of the on Armitage from that concert. Yes, I wrote a story that for that show that they still play. Well, I don't know they played on WFMT quite often about growing up in Chicago, and it was probably the single highest moment of my entire recording life before, up to then and since then in that concert that night. So here we are at Orchestra Hall, which is obviously a place of an emulated, you know, an admired place. And that afternoon, my dad and I went there, and we sat with the janitor or somebody in the back and watched Ishtok Perlman. He did our sound check. I mean, not really, but I mean, he was on stage alone playing, and it was just my dad and this person who worked there and me listening to him just absorbing the sound while he's out there, like in a golf shirt playing his vibe. Yeah, it's an extraordinary day. So I had the single highest moment of my life. So I wrote this story, and I copied it on the banjo. I started playing Chicago, and I'm playing the tune for a second. The audience titters and stuff, and then I'm doing this thing about growing up in Chicago and how coming home in Chicago for me has always been like going on a vacation. And the thing where I hit my highest moment, this will be in my next book where I write about this, is that I said two phone numbers I'll never forget as long as I live are that of my parents and that of Bushell Carpet Cleaners, Hudson 32700. And the whole place sang along, and I didn't ask them to. I mean, everybody knew that jingle, and I just doubled over, and I still remember it. I mean, this was the moment. It was no moment like equal to that. And then a couple years ago, I was in Denver. I had been lecturing at the University of Colorado, and I did another concert the next night at Denver University, and this couple came up to me, and they said they were from Chicago, and it turned out that this man's father was president of Bushell Carpet Cleaners, and now he's nearly 100, and I interviewed him, because I said, well, where does this jingle come from? Tell me everything about it. We had several conversations. conversations. And in fact, I'll see that fellow, the one whose father did that, in Denver next week when I'm there for our program, man.
Amazing.
Yeah.
I've got two more photos.
Sure.
This looks like, is this you at the Armitage building somewhere?
That's the room. That's the Turkle room. Yeah, that's that same band show. I certainly didn't like to take off. I had my, let's see, I have a sweater on, a shirt, an army jacket, and a scarf. I guess it was cold outside.
Some things haven't changed.
Yeah. I've got obviously thermometer problems. Now, what's the picture below? Yeah. That's from one of those parties. I mean, that's not pose. That's me just playing. Oh, I've never seen that one. Well, I guess that's from another one of those parties, because that's why all those people would have been listening. And I'm wearing the same clothes, so.
That would explain it.
No, I've never seen that picture. So, can you make it a little bigger? I'm sorry, I can't see.
We'll make it bigger for everyone listening at home. No, that's the biggest it gets.
Okay. Well, I can't identify who's in the background, but I've never seen that before. But obviously, that's from the same moment. And that's that party.
Fire party.
Yeah, I think that's what party it was. But anyway, I went to several of those parties, and they were really fun because there was music playing all night. And of course, I you couldn't keep me away. I just loved it and wanted to play, and it was fun. And by then, I think I was probably, Fleming turned over his class to me to teach.
In what year?
Well, we could look it up in the records to be accurate. It would have been 74 or 75. Certainly by 75, I'm sure I was teaching his class and using his tablatures that I had learned from him from before. And he had another student who had took lessons at the school much longer than I, and he allowed me to copy all of Fleming's tablatures, and I have them all. And that Sid Morrison had cataloged, and Fleming thought that was about it. So I'm sure there must be more, but it does seem to align itself with his repertory at the same time. So it makes sense. That's probably the preponderance of his tablatures that he would use and reuse. And often he would take a tune and do it in one setting and then bring it back in a different tuning, as I did with your class with Roll on the Ground. And so he would write out, so that'd be 2 weeks worth of tablatures, you know, same tune but different approach.
For how long did you teach at the Old Town School?
Well, I believe I was there 3 years. And I made my living primarily through the Old Town School and teaching there. They had set up a satellite school in Skokie, and I also... The Norris Center at Northwestern had just been built, and I started the banjo classes there, and I gave banjo lessons there. I was sort of like you, in a sense of finding other places around Chicago to teach and play. And the funny thing is, I was always drawn to the historical thing, so I always tried to talk a little bit as best what little I knew. But I had always that interest in the larger context of it. And that gets us right back to this room here, because in listening to those Library of Congress records in this spot many years ago, decades and decades ago, what was striking about the Library of Congress records, unlike their commercial counterparts, because they were recorded in homes, in their homes and churches and all that, the sounds of life were not scrubbed from them. So you hear dogs barking and chickens crowing and trucks driving by and neighbor interrupting while someone's playing and kids laughing and all of that's going on. And that sort of presence, that felt life, that was there. And that's what I heard listening to them here. That was so radically different than any studio record. It's not to say it's superior. It was just different. And it made enormous sense of life to me. And so that sense of what surrounds the music was something that I tried to instill in what little capacity I had as a teacher then. And, you know, I did have a choice in life to follow strictly academe, and I was invited into a doctoral program by Dr. Kenneth Goldstein years ago, and it was the road I did not take, in that sense of doing a dissertation at that time when I was in my early 20s, because he saw a folklorist in me, as you know, someone who had sort of, you know, who liked to write, learned tendencies or something, and that was true. And I just wish he could have lived long enough to read my book now. I do. I think he would have liked it. And I think about him and that invitation. It meant so much. Because he took me to, I don't know if you ever went to Hatboro, PA, because you're a Pennsylvanian.
I haven't.
But that's where Legacy Books was. And Legacy Books, where they were a publisher and a book distributor, and they published many of the early many early folklore books of Ken Goldstein's generation of the 50s and stuff, and important books were coming out of there. And he took me there. He had just gotten rid of his first library, and he was starting another library. And he took me there, and I just went, I spent every penny I ever had to on books there. And the two folks who ran the place, Richard Burns and Lillian Krylov, said they'd never, you know, they saw how much I loved those books, and I read them. I still have them, and it meant so much to me to be around those books. And not books separated from the experience behind them, but just of themselves, a way to acquire knowledge and care about things. And so I've always, you know, been comfortable going between the field experience of being around people and listening to them and seeing what their social environment is, as well as those who write and describe those experiences. The ethnographic experience in my generation in the early 70s, there emerged in the wake of the 1960s what was called the new ethnography. And the new ethnography was, you know, when you put it in context of the other social movements that were going on then, makes sense. It was, what is the item, what is the experience of the person, their experience? So if you go to a jewelry store, it's not what is your experience as a customer, you're studying the experience of the person selling you the ring. What's going on for them? How are they assessing you? What are they thinking about? What is it from the point of view of the player? In other words, if you're studying music, what is the, and that kind of stance, which is old. I mean, Franz Boas, when he did his dissertation, you know, he's studying Eskimos, and their perceptions are situational. They're seeing different color. He was describing different perceptions about different ideas of the color of water. What about that? So that kind of idea has been around, is of trying to ask these people to be witnesses. And in a sense, that informs what is the spirit behind StoryCorps. I saw David Isay, the director of StoryCorps in Washington, at the 40th anniversary of American Folklife Center this past May. I was there. And he makes, of course, he's conscious of the fact that as a predicate to StoryCorps is the type of endeavor that went under in the Federal Writers Project to capture American voices. And that's the same impulse that I'm talking about. So whether we want to call it new ethnography, there had emerged in linguistics idea about grammar of the etic and the emic, phonemic versus phonetic. So phonemic is from within, and the other is from without. So, and you need both. So what... in the introduction to Symbolic Logic, Suzanne Langer is talking about the description of a room from the point of view of the baby and description of a room from the point of view of the architect. You know, they have different priorities, different needs, different ideas about it. You want both. So you want the criminal to tell you about himself, but you also want the criminologist or in my case, the psychiatrist and the patient, you know. Both.
Speaking of recidivism... I'd love to circle back to the Old Town School and get your perspective of it. Walking back in, you know, this week, you visited us last year, and now here we are in 2017, you're visiting classes. What do you see when you walk into the modern version of the Old Town
Growth.
School?
Growth. This is the most wonderful efflorescence. What has happened to the Old Town School is better than it ever was, and it was wonderful then, but it's magical now. The fact that this is the largest community art school in the United States is no surprise. The quality of your teaching and the quality of the facilities and the spirit that's there, this place is just fantastic. I have such admiration for the cohesion, the vision, the diversity, and the quality of instruction, and I see it in you, and I see it in Peggy Browning's classes, and I'm sure that others are that it's extraordinary, and I can only praise it because it's a mighty testimonial to what you guys are doing and have done, and you certainly have never than anything except connect to your past but build upon it in a marvelous way. I mean, folk music, the book I wrote, it's always a story of renewal. And my gosh, You guys are living that. And I knew Dawn Greening. She was my friend. And I knew Wynn Strachey. And they would have been so moved by what you did. I interviewed, when I wrote the entry on the Old Town School for the Encyclopedia of Chicago History, I interviewed Bess Hawes about it because she's the source for Frank Hamilton. And she said she would be in a room and just sort of find easily harmonized songs. And it builds off of that, of you know, something going on in California where she was teaching at that time and living. And then it goes into Frank Hamilton's hands, and you know all the rest, and the beginning of operations in 1957, and the pictures are there for all of us to see. And but what you have done is just marvelous, and what you continue to do, I couldn't be more thrilled. And I just want to know more and more about what you are doing. So how do I find it? Well, I find it magical and exhilarating.
Would you play us a banjo piece that you learned from Fleming?
Yeah, let me think of something. I might need a minute here to think of it.
Yeah, take your time.
Okay, this is something Fleming learned from Hobart Smith and that he taught me. How's that? So...
So great.
Is that okay? That was Pad Roller, and then I went in a little bit of Chinkapin Pie. And Hobart told Fleming, he said that on a record too, they'd go and get chinkapins, they'd pull them off these like these berries, and he said you'd eat a whole bunch of them, you'd get sick, and then you'd eat a whole bunch more. Mm-hmm. And so Chinkapin Pie, and it gets stuck on your leg, these little burrs, you know, and because I walked through it sort of a chinkapin field at one point, and that was true. And on one of my forays for my work, and the first one was the Patroller, and it's a haunting thing because a Patroller is a patroller. It's a human chase song, is what that is. Patroller is like an ICE agent today.
Right. For escaped slaves.
Yeah. So, I mean, in that sense, the Patroller of a time, you know, before the advent of recorded sound, still makes sense today.
Which is unfortunate.
Yeah, it's amazing. And so I think the frenetic quality of it pertains. That's informs it. And so even though it's an instrumental, it has that, content in it, I think. And it certainly informs how I understand the tune.
One thing I want to make sure we talk about before we wrap up.
Uh-oh.
Could you tell us where in the city of Chicago you've lived?
Yeah, well, I was a lakefront liberal, is what they called us. And so we lived near Wrigley Field, and then my family, and then I lived in Lincoln Park area. I lived in the attic of Flying Fish Records when I was young. I was the only Flying Fish artist to actually live there, and it was kind of it's a Very nice house now. It was not quite that way when Bruce Kaplan of Flying Fish Records purchased it, though. But I lived there, and it was a happy time. I briefly lived above the Fertile Delta Plant Shop in Lincoln and Diversey on the third floor there. I had roommates in one apartment, and then that all ended, and so I moved into the apartment next to it. They rehabbed that by myself, and for a brief time, Steve Goodman, I said, I don't know how, it was $200 a month rent, and Steve Goodman said, I don't know how I'm going to afford this. He said, you'll find a way, and so he encouraged me to have my own place, and for a while I did, and then I went on the road a lot, so a fellow named Peter Marston, who was part of Argonne National Laboratories, it was his boat, the Mimi, that was a PBS series that had young Ben Affleck on that boat, The Adventures of the Mimi. Did you ever see that on public television? Well, anyway, that was his boat. He lived in Massachusetts along in the water, and but he would come here every week to work as part of this. He's a scientist with magnetics and at Argonne Lab, and so he would stay at my place, and so that helped me when I was away, that Peter would stay there, and Rosalie Sorrells came over, and we had and it was a little loft, so I remember watching Rosalie Sorrells and her guitarist down on the first part. I was just hanging over my little loft thing there and watching them play, and that was a happy time, but I really couldn't afford it, so Bruce allowed me to live at Fish, I haven't really lived that many places. I haven't been America's Guest in Chicago. I mean, I've just lived in these couple of places. It's rather, you know, about it. I don't think there's anything else.
In which
I was born at Augustana Hospital, which doesn't exist anymore. It was on Dickens and Lincoln. Hmm. So I'm sort of really from the north side.
And then when did you move away from Chicago for good?
Oh, well, it happened, you know, I came to Washington, D.C. to play at the Arena Stage, which is sort of like their Goodman Theater, a subscription theater with several theaters under the same roof. In January 4th, 1981, I came there opening on January 13th, and I was there, I booked for a three-week run, so I certainly didn't expect to live there. But it was a long 3 weeks. I was there for 10 years and 2 weeks. And by then, I just lived there. And that was in southwest section of D.C., so I could walk over Library of Congress, which I had already been going to since the 70s anyway to study there. And so the Archive of Folk Song and the American Folklife Center started in 76. So it made sense. And things that the people I cared about. I had come to Washington originally in 71 because it was the bluegrass capital of the United States, and I knew that. And there was the Center for Recording for Performance. The first Bluegrass Festival in America had occurred in 1965, not far away. And I was aware of these things and wanted to be around those people and that music making. And I was already playing a banjo, and this is before I knew Fleming. So anyway, that's what it was. So coming back to Washington this experience of the music being captured by the Smithsonian and by the Library of Congress, but it was also this blue collar experience of it going on in bars and taverns and festivals and things like that. So there was multiple kinds of audiences and people involved in it. So it was sort of a perfect place for me, and both a learned environment and a musical environment, not to divorce the two, but both elements were there.
Stephen Wade, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you, Matt. Thank you, Salvatore.